Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Ringside Wrap, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we bring you the latest news and information on major pro wrestling and MMA promotions, the occasional history lesson, and interviews with legends of yesterday and stars of today. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Ringside Wrap.
And welcome again, everyone. It is Wednesday, January 18th, 2012, 8 o'clock p.m. on the East Coast, and welcome to Ringside Wrap. I am Mike Sempervivi. Rich Tate is in the production studio right now, busting everything out, and we'll be joined very shortly here by Les Thatcher. I got a good show tonight, obviously. If you haven't checked out the website, ringsidewrap.com, haven't gone there, you would not know that our guest tonight, coming in at about 8:30, will be Terry Taylor. And you know what? For the second week in a row, I have completely butchered the opening of the show, blowing the bumper music, and unfortunately, probably talking over Booker T and the MGs playing Green Onions. Producer Rich, what is wrong with me?
I guess you just can't wait to do the show.
I am so terribly out of alignment here. if you heard the music, you didn't hear me. That was probably a good thing. But let me restart this thing again here. It's the only second week back in the main chair, and I'm already blowing it. I actually am excited for tonight's show to begin, because as I was saying earlier on, 8:30, Terry Taylor is going to join us, and waiting on Les to check in with us here, because there's a bunch I want to go over with him too, but I don't know, arguably the biggest news of the week, not sure, but Evan Bourne, and there's a couple of them, but I kind of want to begin with Evan Bourne here, who recently returned from a 30-day wellness policy violation. Rumors about what it was for, marijuana or what, being the main rumor going around. But he had come back from that 30-day where he remained tag team champions along with Kofi Kingston. And on Monday night, started on Sunday, I believe it was. I believe it was Sunday, where Apico and Primo won the tag titles on a house show, which I remember I saw U.S. title change in Baltimore. I saw, you know, Jeff Jarrett and Edge being one of the last more notable ones that took place a couple of years ago, but it seemed to be a surprise where it was like, wow, okay, I wonder if this is, they're trying to spark house show business, and it is a good idea to have title changes on house shows, give people a reason to go, but then loses quickly on Monday night, and then word comes out that he was suspended for 60 days, and Les has joined us now. And Les, I was kind of thinking about what the biggest news of the week was, and this one I actually think is debatable that it might be, just because of how quickly Evan Bourne was suspended again, coming back after that 30-day suspension. I believe you know Evan a little bit. What do you make of this, or do you make anything at all of this?
I don't make anything of all of my. I've met Evan. I don't really know him. I want to say a lot of positive things. I don't want the censors cutting me off tonight. I just want to state right here for the next however long we're on tonight that if they tell me Hornswoggle's 6'7", I'm going to say he absolutely is, and I agree. And he's probably one of the greatest workers I've ever seen in my life. That's my stance.
Apparently, Rich Tate is sending out checks that I'm not receiving.
I want to continue to make all the big bucks that I'm making shoveling out crap out of my mouth. And that's a 2-hour rant on itself. Probably the reason I don't work for any company is I don't do censorship really well. I don't do it really well for big money. I don't do it at all for nothing. So.
Well, this is the thing with Warren. I guess I was just, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot, who knows? You know, there's a lot we talk about. You know, obviously, the Flair situation. There's a lot of, you know, stories going on. But this one just kind of surprised me. He's not being the biggest thing of the week because it was just, I don't know. It was just
now, to tell you the truth, what little he's just not a kid that I would think that would be, you know, involved. You know, the stupid thing, and I don't know if this is about synthetic marijuana or it's not about synthetic marijuana. I really have no idea. I've read about the stuff. I've never seen it, you know, don't know, never. And having read about it, feel confident enough that I wouldn't partake of it if I had it or if somebody offered it to me. The silly thing about that, you know, you can't have the real stuff, which won't hurt you, but here's the synthetic stuff that'll kill you. Okay, well, I'm amazed at why that stance is taken. I mean, well, they don't condone that either. But I don't know why you'd try the synthetic if you have access to the real stuff. I mean, if I'm going to be suspended, I'm going to be suspended healthy, not, you know, with a chance of injuring myself or I don't know. You know, I don't know if anybody's ever died from this synthetic stuff, but I guess there's been some terrible reactions, and you know, where medical things have had to, you know, to be taken care of. I don't know. You know, I got to wonder where it's going to leave the kid because, you know, I'm sure. God, I hate to say anything negative.
That's one thing that people are, I guess. And who knows if this is where this conjecture is coming from or what it is, but that he would, you know, I guess there's some people with the mentality he was trying to get fired because of the way that the testing so quickly and knowing he was going to be tested so quickly for him to fail again. You know, it could just indicate an issue or a problem too, but it's just hard for me to wrap my brain around anyone. That's, I mean, I know there may not be a whole lot out there or what. I don't really understand what the concept would be of wanting to get fired from WWE for
well. Well, I was going to ask you the same thing. And here again, I mean this with no disrespect towards Matt or Evan or whatever you want to call him. The struggle on the indies to independently book yourself. Is a grind. I mean, it's a grind. Where he's at now, whether he's used well or not used well, he's got a paycheck that's not going to bounce. He's got some sense of some security, and you know, if he's obviously that run's not going to last forever and ever, and you know, so you put it away and ride it out, and you know, until they decide to terminate it, I would think. You know, if you're somebody the star magnitude of a Kurt Angle or a John Cena or you know, or somebody like that, okay, then you ask, cut me loose and I'm going to take my chances because the other company is going to sign me to some, you know, big contract, which may be not as big as this one, but still keep me very comfortable and you know, solvent and my family fed and the mortgage paid. I'm like you. I don't understand, you know, where the average guy, when he has a contract, wants to get out of it. To ascend to that level, everybody's got to have an ego. I mean, we all do. And they have to be fed to a certain degree, but then a little logic and common sense has to come into play, too, and realize that it's not like, you know, there's a million places to go. And this is, I don't know, you know, I don't know what you know more about Japanese market than I would ever know, because I really am not that much into it currently, but the little companies over there, I don't imagine can pay all that well, and it's not steady, you know, steady work, and I don't see him as being a guy that's going in and work with, you know, on top with the big companies. I don't know. But wanting to get fired just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Not in this day and age, anyway.
No, and I mean, when he was actually over there, and this is obviously for those people listening, and you know, the way Evan Bourne flies around, will not be shocked to hear that he was working with Dragon Gate when he was originally over there as, you know, one of the little speedballs. But, you know, at this point, you know, again, and I guess he could go work for Dragon Gate USA or something like that. But, yeah, obviously the money wouldn't be there. And, you know, kind of what made me think about this, too, when it came to the first time I'd ever heard about synthetic marijuana was Spice. And it was soldiers were using it because they were getting tested. So it was something they used at parties. And I guess it has grown. And I know I think we're all God-fearing men here, but I think we've also all kicked it around on this show that, you know, marijuana, and as we are as a culture with medical marijuana, with states, you know, coming off of, you know, and looking differently at it and looking differently at marijuana in general, it seems like sports has actually gotten harder with it. And, again, alcohol, and there's lots of other things that obviously you can get addicted to and could be, you know, cause damage. But do you find it kind of funny that, you know, as a society and as a culture, for the most part, we've gotten a lot more liberal on marijuana, where sports has actually gotten worse about it. And considering the amount of pills, and this is not just wrestling, but all sports, and amount of alcohol abuse and things like that, where do you find it funny that sports is going the complete other way on something that they probably should not be, you know, on about at all?
Yeah, I really do. I really do. It's – I've always thought this, Mike, and not it's not necessarily about wrestling, but it's something in our culture that I know, you know, was commonplace with, like, pro football and probably a lot of pro sports in this, you know, years ago. And maybe, you know, and probably to a certain degree it still is, and it's just not covered. But if I've signed you to a contract and you know, I've got money invested in you, I obviously want to make a return on that money. So if you're injured, let's see, let's have the doctor hit you with cortisone so you can perform, or let's have him give you some, you know, something else that's it's going to get you up to perform. And, well, you know, there was a time in the 70s when it was, in the 60s, I guess, that it was pretty common knowledge that uppers in the NFL were like candy, you know, they were dispensed like M&Ms, and which was all right. Now, the game's over. I'm emotionally wired. I'm up. I'm ramped up and everything. Now I'd like to smoke a joint to come down and relax. Nope, can't do that. You know, I mean, that makes no sense to me. And the craziest thing is, you know, currently – deaths from prescription drugs have multiplied by, I think, three over years ago. You know, I read this someplace here a while back, and I mean, I didn't dwell on it because it wasn't, you know, relevant to myself. That's the crazy thing. You might smoke enough grass to get the munchies enough to eat yourself to death and explode. but you'll never, you know. And I say this with a conviction that I've smoked my share, and I'm not ashamed to, you know, to say so. That doesn't mean that I'm advocating it. You know, and I've known people that have smoked some grass, and, you know, they get paranoid. So they probably shouldn't. But then how many people do you know, or do I know, or does anybody listen to this know, that should never have a drop of alcohol in their life, you know, who end up making fools of themselves or become very, you know, irritating and people you don't want to be around. So, but the thing with the prescription stuff is, I think there must be an underlying thought, which has never been in my mind, that, well, the doctor gave it to me, so I can take, you know, so it's, there's no way it can hurt me. And we both know that's crazy, because how many deaths have we seen related to prescription drugs, not only in, you know, sports of all kinds, but just, you know, the general public. How many housewives, you know, without realizing it, take too many sleeping pills or too, you know, or this or that, and end up, you know, dying from it. I think the whole thing is, I don't know why it's not, when I say legalize, and I don't mean, you know, for sale on every street corner and, you know, vending machines to dispense it. But it's just, you know, we realize the harm of alcohol, the harm of, you know, actual cigarettes, that's been documented over and over. But yet, you know, and our government worries about, you know, its budget and, you know, the how much the national debt keeps rising. And yet, I think everyone's in agreement that if marijuana were legal and taxed and, or, you know, well, the medical is what, 14 or 15 states now where that's, you know, where if you have a prescription, you can buy medical marijuana. And there was a time when this government of ours supplied medical marijuana. And
yes,
due to several people, to a handful of people, and this right as of today, that I know for a fact. So, yeah, it's a strange thing to me. It really is. But you're right. While, you know, while the general consensus gets to be more relaxed, and I you know, I think more people, more intelligent people that I hear, you know, discuss this particular subject over the last few years are all in agreement that at some point it will be legalized, you know, or at least decriminalized anyway. And yet, you're right, sports is like this is some, well, you know, having been a bodybuilder and, you know, taking some across-the-counter supplements, that amazes me too. You know, that, I mean, that some of those things are banned. And honestly, having taken some of them, I don't even, you know, the benefits are so minute that I don't even understand that. You know, Anadrol and some Anastinian and some of this stuff that you know that you can buy at GNC or Vitamin World or anything like that. That, you know, baseball or somebody, if they catch it in your system, they're gonna, you know, fine you, suspend you, or something like that. I you know. I'm at a lack for an answer to why that's such a big deal, really.
That would have been like bigger, stronger, faster. And they had that documentary about steroids, where they're talking to, it was actually a lawyer who was a bodybuilder and was actually pro steroids, as far as, you know, if you use these things correctly, and why we crack down and get so excited about things. It was like, you know, the only reason that baseball outlawed androstenedione was it happened to be in Mark McGwire's locker. And they go off on that, and they end up, you know, kind of attacking the wrong things. Now, I don't agree with him when it comes to steroids to a point, but, you know, there is a point there because these are things prescribed by doctors. And actually, there's a caller that's been waiting on the line for a while, so should get to him, a caller in the Bay Area of Florida. Caller, are you there?
Yeah, I am. Actually, it's a Bay Area number, but I make my home here in Atlanta, Georgia. Les Thatcher, this is Danny Olney. How you doing, sir?
Hello, Danny. How are you?
I'm good. I was actually calling real quick to just talk about a point, but when I heard you guys talking about the whole marijuana issue, it kind of like sparked a new point that I wanted to throw out there in my head. Yeah, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the comedian Bill Hicks, but he said it best when he was talking about, in general, the war on drugs, which mainly marijuana has taken the front of that war. He said it's not a war on drugs, it's a war on personal freedom, which is very much the truth. You know, you were talking about prescription drugs and how if you get hurt, you can go to the doctor and he'll give you a prescription for this, or if you're sick, he'll give you a prescription for that. And then you read, you know, the literature that comes with these prescriptions, and it's 3 to 4 pages long of what it can do to you, what prolonged use can do, what overdoses can do. And it's just like you said earlier, if you look at the literature that would come with marijuana, it would be 3 lines. Might make you tired, might make you hungry, might make you want more pot. You know, and it's just, it's ridiculous to me that it's still illegal. I mean, especially like you said, you know, it's perfectly okay to come home and drink a 6-pack of beer, which would probably lead to some very bad decisions. But God forbid you come home and smoke a joint, then all of a sudden you're an outcast, which is especially in 2012, it's asinine. I can't put logic behind it.
No, I can't either. You know, a friend of mine who was in the Navy, this is a number of years ago, and was stationed on one of the big aircraft carriers, had sent me a letter saying that, you know, how their stance on marijuana. He said, but the crazy thing about that it was okay to go out and get strung out on prescription drugs or blind drunk out of your mind on alcohol, but don't you dare smoke a joint. You know,
exactly.
You know, which in truth, it, you know, if you've partaken, anyone has partaken, you know, you can function. I'm not much with alcohol myself at all. I'm a social drinker occasionally, but I'm not, I never understood it even as a kid. You know, I was a designated driver before there was such a thing. I drive my buddies around on Saturday night and they say pull over and they hang their head out the door and that, you know, and I think, oh, and they're having fun and they're going to do this next weekend. This is not the kind of fun that I'm really looking forward to myself anyway. But yeah, it's a strange culture. It really is.
And it's no mystery to anybody in Georgia that I like to drink, and it's made me make some bad decisions, some that I regret, some that I don't, but at the same time, I'm a grown man, you know, I made those decisions and I had to deal with the consequences. But, you know, when you look back in the history of everything, you know, no one can tell me one documented case of someone dying from an overdose of marijuana.
No.
People have literally drank themselves to death. People, as you said, have taken too many sleeping pills and fallen asleep and not woken up. You know, people have taken painkillers to get through the day and not woken up. So it's a little bit, I don't know, it's suspect to me. But the main reason I was calling, you know, you sent me an email today or a reply to my email that you had read the little article that I've written. And I wanted to let you know that I have already received my first bit of negative backlash over that. And the negative backlash was directed at someone that I've kind of, I don't want to say taken under my wing because I'm still, you know, relatively green in this business, but it's a young kid in wrestling that I'm trying to, you know, help out, mentor, I guess you could say, along the way. And someone approached him and said that he has a chip on his shoulder because he's being mentored by people like me who have a bad attitude. And apparently that attitude is get better or get out. So apparently that is a bad attitude to have in wrestling, that you need to get better or you need to get out. And he said that the promoters that booked myself and this gentleman they have the same chip on their shoulders and the same attitude, which, again, is apparently a negative one to have. If you're under the thought process that you either need to get better or get out, that's the wrong attitude to have, whereas the right one is, yeah, I'm terrible and I know it. I'm not going to go to training. I'm not going to go to the gym. I'm just going to continue to be terrible and slowly kill wrestling day by day. That apparently.
But you know, I'm glad you called. I sent you an email just a little while before I came on this program. And if you happen to read it, we're not going to mention the man's name who I mentioned in there because we're not going to bring him in. But as I told you, I sent this to several people, Mike being one of them. And anyway, I received an email back from this from a very, very good friend and a gentleman who obviously understands this industry. And he just saw it through a different light. Now, and I wrote back to him and said, well, you know, I see your points and I actually agree with them. But I more read between the lines, I think, when I read it, knowing you. And there were things rather than editing some of the things you said, if I hadn't sent it to him, he probably wouldn't have finished reading. And he made a point that it never crossed my mind, Danny, to be honest with you, but I'm going to mention it to you now. And because I had sent you, the funny thing is when I sent the email, I said, give me a call the next day or so and we could discuss it. But that was where you made the references to Snug. And he was saying to him, that's, is not, the right thing either in our business. And he paraphrased someone who made the comment that, you know, we used to have these fake matches that the fans thought were real, and we called them marks. Now guys beat the hell out of each other, and the fans call it fake. So who's really the marks?
Yeah, and you know what? I do agree with that. You know, the term we used to kick around, and I think you heard us kick it around when you came down here for the camp, was learn how to work, kid. You know, and you know anybody can go out there and punch somebody as hard as they can, but you know, to be an artist in this sport is to be able to make it look like you're killing someone without actually killing them. And, you know, I talk to people a lot, and I tell them it's funny, especially in today's generation, you know, and I'm only 6 years in, you know, but I see this a lot. There's this dichotomy in professional wrestling where sometimes if you're in the ring with somebody you hate, you beat the crap out of them. If you're in there with somebody you love, you beat the crap out of them. And if you're in there with somebody you don't really know, then you work, you know, you take it easy on them, you know, and me and Hayden are good friends. So we both, you know, liked to, you know, and like I said, we weren't injuring each other. It's just, we knew each other was there, but I definitely see the point that, you know, it is a work. And, you know,
well, you know, he brought up the name of a guy who is known as a legitimate badass, right?
Right.
Who he had worked with. And he said, I never felt him and didn't feel him that night. And I sure wasn't sore from working with him the next day. And I wrote back to him saying, well, you know, I've said the same thing many times over and over, and I've said, you know, I've worked during my era with some legitimate badasses who could probably clean out an independent locker room without much trouble today if they were young enough. And I never knew they were there, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just – and I, like him, I hear this strong style thing, and I think, okay, somebody is feeding their own – you know, feeding their ego, you know, because I don't see the value in being – well – you know, we went through this discussion here on the Ring of Honor internet pay-per-view, and I've talked to, you know, a couple other shows I've been on about the same thing, is like, you know, it's the idea is to convince the people sitting in the chairs and they can't feel a thing. And,
right.
You know, back in my era, if I'd have felt you too many times, then there would have been a problem.
Yeah, right, right.
We got home early.
Yeah.
But, you know, the other thing that I wanted to mention, too, about that is when I did a thing with Mike Johnson, Semper Visa, you still there?
Yeah, man.
Okay. There's a documentary that Mike Johnson interviewed the director of, and I can't remember for the life of me, but it was done on a group, an indie group in North Carolina. And this guy, and it was there. Mike Johnson made a comment about the old Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney, let's have a show, you know.
Right.
And I did a thing with him today, which I guess will be up on their board tomorrow. I said, well, there's a counterpoint to that, because those who actually want to try to make it in the wrestling business are held back by those people who just want to play. And your
right.
points, and this guy who wrote to me about, you know, the snug comment said the same thing. He said, you know, absolutely, that's one of the biggest complaints, I think, with everybody. And here's the deal. What I mean by that is the director of this documentary was saying how what these were just wonderful kids, and they were nice, you know, and I'm sure they are. I'm sure they love their mothers and go to church and all that, but that's not the point. I mean, I had a dream years ago, and I love basketball, but I'm just over a foot too short and just didn't have the proper talent. So, you know, I didn't
have... Kind of wipe that one out.
Huh?
Kind of wipe that one out then, didn't it?
Yeah, but you did, you know, but you didn't have to... Honestly, I didn't have to be told, and I have been told, you know, I'm known as the devil of Cincinnati because I won't blow smoke up some kid's butt. In fact, I, you know, someone made a comment. Someone had worked in my company and went to some indie and said, well, you know, he ruins young man's dreams. Yes. But at some point, somebody has to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
And that's the problem with the indies in general, is that, you know, this guy will work. Well, somebody else that I'd sent your post to, Danny, had said that they were just, you know, they had quit working, booking them. This is somebody who had been in the big time. They quit booking themselves out to the indies because it, you know, they called it ticket sellers. In other words, you go out and sell 50 tickets, I'll put you in the main event. You may not be able to slap your ass with both hands, but I'll put you in my main event because, you know, your mom and dad and 30 of your relatives bought tickets or something. And that's the stance of the and my comment as a promoter, and I said, guys, probably like Harley, you know, Bob Evans, Danny Davis and OVW, the problems we've found with just, you know, these guys that want to play at this is they put a show on, no matter what they charge to get in, fans that actually watch professional wrestling or want to watch professional wrestling see this and they're, you know, wow, we spent money to watch this and it's not what we thought it would be. So, you know, they have a negative attitude. Then some other little company comes into that area and does the same thing, and maybe they take it a second chance. Well, by the time some company like OVW or Harley's World League Wrestling or whoever that legitimately is trying to promote something serious or you know, Anarchy or whoever it happens to be, they don't have a huge television or a huge marketing budget, so they can't tell you that, well, we're sorry you wasted your money the first two times, but you won't waste it on us. So by the time that third company gets here that is legitimate, they're not going to sell tickets because the people have already been turned off.
Hey, Les.
Exactly.
Hey, Danny, got to wrap up with you right now. Danny, only
yeah, I was actually going to say I got to run.
Get ready for Terry Taylor to come on, but everyone can go to GWHnews.com and check out Commitment and Knowing When to Quit, the piece that you did. And when Les and I come back, we're going to invite on Terry Taylor, so we'll be right back.
Wait a minute, Danny, let me give me a shout at the house in the next couple of days, okay? Okay.
Hi, this is Ozzy Osbourne. For many years, you know I've had a drink problem and I'm trying to battle that problem every single day. But one thing I don't do, I don't drive my car when I'm drinking. I get someone to drive me. Do not drink and drive. It's the stupidest thing. If you drink, just don't drive. Not only are you going to hurt yourself, you may hurt some other person, and you wouldn't want that on your conscience, would you?
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having three number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn the signs of autism at AutismSpeaks.org. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Solie? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
Hello there, I'm Patty Loveless. Kids have a lot on their plates these days. It can be hard as parents to stop and think about how something like learning music now can help them in the future. Music helps kids because it's a performing art, and children need to learn to perform well to succeed in society. Getting an 85% on a math test is pretty good, but hitting 85% of the right notes during a concert isn't good enough for most music students or their teachers. A special kind of practice and preparation goes into the discipline of performing music, and it helps kids perform better in all areas of their lives.
A PSA brought to you by MENC, the National Association for Music Education, and the National Anthem Project, the campaign to restore America's voice through music education. March is Music in Our Schools Month.
Georgia wrestling fans, you're going to want to make your plans to be at Johnny G's the first, third, and fifth Sunday of every month, 2 p.m. bell time, for Rampage Pro Wrestling television taping. And fans, if you're in Middle Georgia, make sure that you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24, Saturday 9 a.m. on the My 41.2, Saturday at 10 p.m. Cox Communications Cable, Thursday 8, Saturday at noon, and of course, Rampage Rewind, the one-half-hour show on Cox Communications throughout the schedule. Fans, be there.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a
bear sighting?
Location?
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
All right, we're back here on Ringside Rap. Mike Sempervivi and Les Thatcher along with you. I'd like to introduce our guest for this evening, Mr. Terry Taylor. Terry, how are you doing tonight?
Never better. Thank you guys for having me on.
You're just like fine wine, aren't you? You get better with age.
Oh, boy.
Hey, you know,
I haven't talked to you in a long time.
No, I know, and that's... That's a shame, but I understand when you get big in the business and you don't need the old guys, it helps you along the way, and I understand that.
That's me. I don't care about anybody but me.
I know how you are. My Sempervivi don't pay attention to us. We pick at each other like this for all the time, so it's no big
deal. You're still mad at me about that first lockup in Knoxville where I almost crippled you.
Yeah, there you go.
You don't remember that, do you?
How could I forget it? We were just talking to a young man who's on the indies about that, you know, loose, you know, these guys that talk about strong style and beat the hell out of each other. And I said, I've worked with some legitimate badasses in my time and never felt them. I you weren't one of those badasses, but I remember feeling you.
I didn't know any better than you taught me.
Go ahead. Tell him, Terry. Tell him the story.
I'd been in the business about 15 minutes, and I already knew everything. So when this old-timer got in there and said, well, let me see what you got for the show, you know, Les was going to – I didn't appreciate it at the time, but he was going to share some of his knowledge. And I was like, what can he possibly tell me? I already know everything. And we locked up, and I – you know, everybody says lock up snug, and I have a different definition of snug now than I did then, and it's probably changed like 42 times to be looser every time. I locked up with and drove him to his knees, and I heard about 19 cuss words all tied together. It ended up with loosen the F up. Jeez, God, what the? And that's when I learned that the lockup was a work, too.
And he learned some of the words he'd never heard before, too.
I'd heard him since a lot of times.
Yeah, we go back a long way. What year was it? That was 80? Was it 80 or 81?
1980, yeah. It was about 2 months, 3 months after I broke in, and I didn't know anything.
Well, your ascension into the wrestling business is unique. I mean, unique in itself because how you were – I just saw the kayfabe commentaries rebooking the UWF that you had done, and I had never known till then that you basically had your first match on TV against Bugsy McGraw. Your ascension into the business was just mind-boggling as far as how that came about. What was it like? I mean, going in so quick and having everything be a blur. I mean, how difficult was it to kind of learn along the way, or did you just instantly suck everything in like a sponge?
No. back then, I mean, I don't think people understand the magnitude of the freak nature of me being in the wrestling business. Les knows because he was part of it. But in 1979, guys would break other people's arms if they said wrestling was fake. Or if somebody was riding with some, you know, like two opponents were riding with each other, you know, somebody in the locker room would light them up. I mean, they protected, they being the wrestlers, it was a tight-knit fraternity, and they protected it because that's how they paid their bills. It wasn't a part-time job. They weren't playing video games. I mean, it was deadly serious to those guys. And Steve Muslin, I think you may have known him, Les, or Steve Travis.
Sure, I did. I knew Steve, yeah.
Yeah. I went to college with him, and he actually got broken into the business. And I went to West Palm Beach on a Monday night, and he was there wrestling, plus many others. And he said, come on to the back. And I had no idea, you know, how big a deal that was. But he took me back and introduced me to Dusty and, you know, Jack Briscoe, Jerry Briscoe, Dusty, all these guys that I idolized. And I knew they knew I was a phony, that I didn't belong. But I kept my mouth shut, and, you know, they never figured it out. And then I went to TV on Wednesday and just to watch. And Chick Donovan missed his flight, and Eddie Graham said, you got your stuff, kid? I was getting ready to say no, and Muslin was behind Eddie Graham jumping up and down going, yeah, you got your stuff. I said, yes, sir. So I borrowed a pair of tights and boots, and I was on TV a half hour later getting kicked by Bugsy as hard as he could. 3 minutes. So that was my start.
That start in a territory where Jack Briscoe, there are stories of Eddie Graham and Bob Roop, and there's all of those stories that took place. I mean, one, I guess then, at any point, did you look around and go, oh, Jesus, or were you just so gung-ho that, there was never any pause for concern or anything like that, that you weren't, you know, a seasoned worker or weren't a worker really at all at that point?
Well, I was scared out of my mind. The first year and a half I was in the business, I was afraid somebody's going to figure out I didn't belong. And, you know, once you kind of get in and guys, you know, you're making trips with them and stuff, and I kept my mouth shut the first 2 years, 3 years. I said yes, sir, and no, sir, and that was it. And nobody really knew. Nobody knew I didn't have any training. Manny Fernandez, Steve Kern, and Les, on that one lockup, and then he said he never wanted to see me again. But, you know, I was very lucky that guys tried to help me. And I was very grateful. I wasn't a guy that thought I knew everything. I was just extraordinarily thankful to be in the business.
Yeah, you make that reference about how it was serious business and everything back then. That's like when the kid, Nick Jackson or whatever the hell his name is, made the stupid statement about unprotected chair shots and taking back bumps. Lance Storm had said, not only should this kid learn to work, he should learn to keep his mouth shut. And he said it kind of makes you yearn for the days when guys got their that talk like this got their asses handed to them every night and finally understood they shouldn't be in the business at all. But, yeah, it was... Yeah. It was a whole different ball game. It really was, and it's. Don't you think, Terry, too, that the difference in attitude has, in part, has been what's changed the business into more of a show. It was always a show, but I mean, you know, more of vaudeville entertainment, and you know, more concerned about hand signals and catchphrases and music, and than it is about the actual in-ring product.
Yeah, I think that's true of entertainment all the way around. I mean, look in Hollywood. Name one actor that you're compelled to watch by their performance. It's all CGI, you know, monsters and bigger explosions. And the audience, it's very hard to please the audience now. But I used to liken wrestling to magic. If you watch a magic trick done well, you never get tired of seeing it. But the second you see how it's done, you feel stupid because you see the guy pulling it out of his sleeve or whatever the trick is, and it's like, ugh. And I think that's what's happened to wrestling. It's the performances and the work is so bad that it's not magic anymore. You know, really
yeah.
hitting each other with chairs, there's no art to that. Diving off the top through a table, there's no skill involved. It's just stunt
right.
work where you dive on stuff.
I think, too, that one of the major downfalls, or maybe just because I've been a part of the business for so long, it's so much it stands out to me, is that we build everything in the ring, and this paint-by-number stuff is just what you see. It's an acrobatic exhibition, and it's we, and you know, you get an ooh and an ah from it, but that particular type of exhibition doesn't draw money. It comes, you know, it's like some of these young guys, some of the young fans on these websites and stuff now, Terry, have, you know, the hue and cry is Helmsley and Undertaker are going to be the main event. Why the old guys? Well, because the old guys understand what the word psychology means, and they understand how to make people get emotionally invested. And the kids, more, I think, to a degree, entertain themselves opposed to being concerned with entertaining the people that buy the tickets.
I agree with that. If you lay out a match in the back that you want to do, then you completely take the art out of what we used to do, which is give the audience what they want by calling it on the fly. I mean, if you and I were going to work together, 9 times out of 10, we wouldn't have seen each other until we got in the ring. Couldn't lay everything out. We had to judge by the audience reaction what they were buying and what they weren't. And we could have a good match by listening to how the people reacted. Guys can't do that now because they lay everything out in the back. So,
yeah.
I don't know. The art that we did and we loved is gone. And, I mean, it is going to be gone. And us lamenting is not going to bring it back. But, boy, I sure wish it could.
Now,
yeah.
You can't get the genie back in the bottle, but we talk about it a lot of, you know, week after week, and, you know, because a lot of wrestling fans have become MMA fans, and much like, I've always looked at boxing, mixed martial arts, and wrestling, they're all related cousins, not just because of a canvas mat, but because you want to draw the people in, separating them from their money to see two people have conflict. The UFC proves it, and, you know, you always get a lot of laments from people of, well, WWE is the only guy out there, and what are you going to do? And, you know, it's just this way now. It seems to me that it's, and we talk about it week after week on here, and I'd like to hear your opinion on it. It just seems to be that, you know, the sports thing is just the thing. You know, it's much like the UFC and why they're successful now. It's just the same things that pro wrestling did. I mean, the athletic, seeing two athletic people going at each other, you know, with some sort of story and conflict and some sort of personality, I mean, I don't see how that can't come back, you know, and that, is that impossible, or is it just my pipe dream?
No, I think UFC has done well, and it's the way wrestling used to be done. Wrestling got away from what made itself popular, which is compelling stories and compelling characters that were larger than life, put in these extraordinary circumstances with, you know, a physical confrontation with a satisfying outcome. That's what Ultimate Fighting does now, and they do it well. And I think that if it was done properly, wrestling could have the same. And I don't know if it'd ever be the glory days again because people know it's showbiz, but there was a time in the 80s and 90s where people didn't care if it was real or not. And they enjoyed the suspension of disbelief because what they were seeing was good.
You know what I find the problem with the current product is, well, I don't know if both of you guys watched the football playoffs over this past weekend, but the San Francisco-New Orleans game was tremendous. And the last, I mean, 4 lead changes in the last 4 minutes, and San Francisco wins it with, you know, scores to win it with 8 seconds left on the clock. And I had said to somebody that I was talking to about, real life is so sometimes is, you know, the thing about being stranger than fiction, but the point is that was exciting and I got excited about it. In our business, we have the chance to create that type of excitement, and instead we don't anymore, you know, because for whatever reason. And I think that's sad too, because, you know, we have that possibility to create, like you know, like that San Francisco New Orleans game did, and bring people to the edge of the seat and get them emotionally invested. Well, you know, here's the thing too, Mike. Terry and I both have worked for WWE at one time or another, and their stance is to send everybody home happy. And Terry will tell you whether it's the Tampa territory, the Oklahoma territory, the Knoxville territory, you didn't draw money by sending people home happy every night. Am I right, Terry?
Yeah, no, he draws. You got to have the people mad so you can have a righteous savior. And sometimes you got to have the evil guy get over to set the stage for the big conflict. So, yeah, I mean, what's the old saying when the territory's down? Get heat. And you don't get heat if the good guys always win.
Terry, you've been involved in many great things over the years. One always sticks out to me, and in fact, I can actually, and this shows you that when you do things right, that people remember it forever. The thing I'm always going to remember you for is the Chris Adams, turning on Chris Adams in the UWF. I can even hear Jim Ross, you know, sounds like a pretty good deal to me, Key. And, you know, when Chris Adams wanted the thing thrown out and stricken from the record, and just, I was actually thinking about that today, and it was like, you know, I was, whatever, 10, 11 years old when that, and I could still remember it word for word, the whole thing. And I started thinking about all the different things I've seen you in over the years, and out of all of those things, was there a angle or a storyline that you that involved you that you put above anything else, or is, you know, what do you look at as one of the more seminal moments of your career as far as one of those angles where you just everybody was feeding into it and it was just, is there anything you think is the best thing you've ever done?
Other than the Red Rooster, let me think. I think that whole Mid-South run at 3 years, I called Bill Watts after 10 years after it was over with, and I called him and I said I want to thank you for letting me be a part of something that was historical. I was kind of a pain in the rear end back then, but the, you know, we were driving 3,000 miles a week, we were working 9 times a week, we were gigging ourselves every night, but I didn't understand how great that period of wrestling was and how people like would say what you just did, that Chris Adams thing was so good and that so many of the angles and that era was just one of the, you know, bright spots in their lives where they're going, man, that was great. And I remember this and that. So I think Mid-South was probably my, you know, I mean, the most fun because, you know, everybody, it was like, it was good. There was 18 guys on the roster, and every single guy had to do their part to keep the whole thing going. And if you were hurt, the other guys, you know, rallied around you and made sure that you got to the town, and the guy you worked with worked around your injury. And, you know, if a guy messed up, the locker room took care of it. Well, Watts didn't have to, because we all depended on each other, you know, to, I don't know, it's just part of being a team that really produced. And it was a great time to be a wrestling fan and a wrestler. And I told Watts, I said, thank you. He thought I was being a smart aleck, but I really meant it. I was very grateful. So that whole Mid-South thing from the beginning when I got there to tagging with Duggan to turning on Chris, that was a great time for me. I had a wonderful time back then.
Another thing you really talk about in the kayfabe commentary was, you know, killing Houston with your first angle that you had booked. And this was in the time that Ken Mantell was coming in from World Class, but he hadn't finished up there yet. And you had quit, went to the Carolinas and to work for Crockett again, yet Bill Watts called you back and asked you to help out. One thing you didn't get into on that, and I'd like to know, is because it was your first booking job, why you? Why did he say, hey, why don't you come up and help me with this, with, as opposed to, I don't know, you know, Bill Dundee, or there are a million and one guys who may have had more experience or that Watts may have trusted. Why was it you that got called up for that?
If I'd have thought about it, I probably would have, if I wouldn't have been so young and arrogant or whatever the word was, I probably would have asked that question. I thought I could do it. I mean, honestly, you don't, when you're young and strong and got all that aggression and testosterone and stuff, you don't know what you can't do. So when he called, I said, man, I can do this, because I wanted to. And then when I got in there, it's what happens, I think, to every booker, is the reality of the job overwhelms somebody when they first sit down in that seat because they don't understand the magnitude of the personalities, of pleasing the audience, of staying in budget. You know, there's a lot to that job. And, I mean, it's hard work, it's stressful, and, you know, all that. I never knew any of that. I just figured I'd show up and start laying out these ideas and it would just all work. And then I found out that I had to be better prepared.
I was sent that DVD and I watched it. I laughed when you were telling Sean about when you started helping Kevin and you booked 6 months in advance. And he said, well, that's all well and good.
And he I was being funny, but it's true.
Yeah. Oh, you're right.
I know what to do with this guy, and I can have an angle for these guys. And in 6 months, we can put these two guys together. And Kevin looked at me and just, you know, Kevin is. Yeah, I think I'm effing stupid, brother. This guy won't work with this guy. This guy's contract won't let this guy work with this guy. These guys don't speak the same language. And I legitimately had a wife say, she didn't want her husband working with another guy. Oh, yeah, yeah. So you have to figure out how to make it work within all those, you know, boundaries and personalities.
You know, I just thought of when I found out you were going to be on tonight, too, I was thinking, too, that I remember when you first tried to, I think it was when you first tried to do color on WCW, that I remember you, next time we had a chance to talk, or I don't know what, and you said to me, you said, I never respected what you did as a commentator until after I tried to do it.
That's right. It's a lot harder. I mean, I've told people that play-by-play is the hardest job in the wrestling business. Making, you know, not sounding like an idiot, using the same words over and over, and keeping the bus on the right route while the talent is, you know, the idea is to keep the storyline on track while your color guy is describing the scenery. And it's hard. I mean, play-by-play is brutally hard, and I respect anybody that does it.
Don't you think, you know, we talk about the difference between calling it in the ring versus laying everything out in the dressing room, and basically it's turned to that on the microphone because, you know, back when, myself or Soli or Cottle or Lance Russell or any of us, you know, were doing it in the 70s, we were calling it all in the ring, too. I mean, we didn't have anybody in our ear. You know, we made some crib notes on the borders of a run sheet or a format and went out there and called what we saw. You know, I told Taz a few years ago when he was still with WWE, we were talking, and I said, I don't know how I would function with somebody trying to put words in my mouth, in my ear, while I'm thinking south and they're talking north. That's got to be even more difficult. But yet, I think that's part of what's, you know, taking the creativity out of the business as well. Because without Ross, you know, it's not, you know, Mike and Taz are good guys and Lawler's a good guy. But without Ross on a microphone, there's nobody in the industry right now that has the art of being able to make something good better or to cover a mistake the way, you know, it should be done.
Yeah. JR, you know what JR was? He's like the John Madden of wrestling because he's like a fan. JR says the stuff we would say sitting next to him at a bar watching the matches.
Yeah.
But he knows the backstory and he knows why we're in, you know, he lets us know why we should be interested in what's going on. And he's a phenomenally gifted performer. I mean, and I know he works hard. I mean, I know he works hard. But he was, I'll tell you what, him calling Steve Austin matches, I'll never forget how good it was. And like when Mick Foley got thrown off the top of the cage, you know, just the emotion and everything that he said is what I was feeling. Good God almighty, they've killed him. I'll never forget it. Stone Cold. I mean, I think JR was legitimately excited. He never seemed forced or put on. And I was with him. I was like, yeah, man, this is awesome. So.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that missing, not just with the in-ring product, but with the microphone product as well, is you don't. I told Nigel when he started doing it with Kelly on Ring of Honor. He was in town here a while back, and we had lunch, and we were talking about it. And I said, here's the thing. I said you're not old enough, maybe to remember, but Johnny, the people that advertised on the old Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, a lot of them had Carson plug the products live because they felt that the viewers, believed in Carson and he could sell them anything. And I told Nigel, I said, there's the first point. I said, you got to understand it's, you can't, like years ago, some guys would say the whole building's on their feet. And of course it's television and nobody's on their feet. And so you're shooting your own credibility in the foot. I said, you've got to create your own credibility to be able to sell the product. And I think that's what's lacking, with the microphones today.
Well, and I think you'll agree with this, Les. Chief J. Strongbow used to say to me, he'd go, if you don't believe the promo, if you in your heart don't believe the promo you're giving, how can anybody out there believe it? He said, you have to feel it. And you have to put your whole body and soul into it, or nobody else is going to believe it. And I feel the same way about announcers.
Yeah.
If they've got to, believe in the product, and I think they have to, however they set their mind, to get in that mindset of telling the people why they should care about it, why this is important. We can see the moves. Tell me why it matters. Give me the history. Tell me about these guys and why I should care about why they're beating each other up.
Okay. Yeah, that's the other thing I had told Nigel, too. I said, as a wrestler, sit down and watch Troy Aikman on football or you mentioned Madden or something. I said, somebody that has been a part of the sport, you need to add depth to what Kelly's saying by telling the people why this guy has a chance to win or why he's behind, offensively, because he hasn't picked up on what the other guy's move or this or that. The other thing I said, to add more interest, to get them to get more interested and more in depth into what's happening in there, not just to say, yeah, he's a tough guy, or yeah, I could, something like that. And you're right. That was the thing. JR, someone had sent him an email about him and I working together, and he said he never looked at me as a color man, as more as an analyst. And that's the way I always looked at myself when I was working. When I wasn't doing play-by-play, and when I worked with him or worked with Cottle, it was more, okay, you're the ex-football player, the ex-basket, you're the Charles Barkley or the Troy Aikman or Chris Collingsworth or whoever it happens to be, and and that's what drives me crazy. Love Jerry Lawler to death as a person, and I realize he does what he's paid to do, but when I hear him wet himself over something that's silly, and I'm thinking, my God, you're a grizzled veteran, battle scarred, and why would you, it doesn't make sense for you to get excited about something so trivial, but I realize he's being paid to do what he's told, so.
Yeah, I don't, we talk about the in-ring performances and how, we think it should be done, but I would hate to be a wrestling commentator now, because the matches go 4 minutes. You've got to sell the pay-per-view, what's coming up next, what the big storyline is, the live event that's coming. I mean, they give you a list of stuff to talk about in 4 minutes, and if you get to talk about the match at all, it's a bonus. And I don't know. It seems like the wrestling business has become a sightseeing tour, and the bus driver's going 100 miles an hour.
Very good analogy.
State Building. Whoa, there goes the Grand Canyon. Well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
62 miles long, it's 4 miles wide and 2 miles deep, and it took 18 million years for it to be divided, and you miss all that because you're already gone.
The thing you say about the 4 minutes is also why most of these young kids actually don't know how to work in the sense that you and I understand work, because you can't learn that in 4 minutes.
Yeah, I would, if somebody said to me, what would you do in 4 minutes, I'd say I'd do one thing. I wouldn't try to get an 8-minute match done in 4 minutes where nothing means anything. I would try to make one thing that I do catch the people's attention and make it matter. And if I'm going over, it's the finish. If I'm losing, it's something to set up the finish. And, I mean, I don't know. If you get introduced to two people in a room, you remember both of them. If you get introduced to 60, chances are you don't remember any of them.
Yeah.
Same thing with high spots and moves.
Exactly. You know, Mike was talking about Watts and that crew, and I met Bill when he first was breaking into business in Indianapolis, but then I worked with him, you know, during the war in Atlanta in 73 and 74, and so I know what it was like to work with him in the office. But Bill, now, some of these kids wouldn't last 5 minutes working with Bill. Talk about some of your experiences of working with Bill and what a stickler he was for detail and so forth.
Well, the good thing about Bill is the thing that I hated about him as a boss. I mean,
right.
I was a wrestler that got up at noon and drove to the town and got there 5 minutes before I was supposed to. I mean, I didn't understand that somebody had booked that town, somebody had spent money promoting it, you know, a bunch of guys had gone in there early to set the ring up. I didn't think about anything other than my 15 minutes being out there as the most important thing. You know, I just didn't understand. And Watts, it was his money, it was his company, it was his ring, it was his truck, it was his promoting. I mean, he was the one who invested his time and effort and life savings into it, and I didn't understand why he was so difficult. And he wasn't really difficult, but I thought as a, you know, a selfish wrestling talent, he was difficult. You know, be on time, what? Do these promos to try to sell tickets, what? You know, I didn't understand all that, but I do now. You know, God put me in the office, and I got to work with a bunch of guys that were just like I used to be. But Bill Watts, I mean, he ran it like a business. If there's anything I can honestly say that I learned from Bill, it's that he ran wrestling like a business, and he made us accountable for our actions. If you were late, you got fined. If your performance was subpar, he let you know it. And he didn't just let guys skate by because they were TV wrestlers. You worked for him. It was done his way, on his terms, or he fired you. And I mean, that's almost like real sports. Because in football, if you fumble the ball enough times, they cut you. I don't care how fast you are. You know, if you're not reliable. Terrell Owens, if you can't get along with the other team members, they get rid of you no matter how good you are. And Bill Watts taught me that, you know, I wasn't bigger than the business, that I was one member of a very important elite team that was lucky enough to be working in that territory with another bunch of great guys that all had the same, you know, vision and goal, which is to make Mid-South good and profitable.
Yeah, I enjoyed working with Bill, too. At that time in the Atlanta office with he and Leo, my God, you talk about the creative juices for, I mean, Lord, that was an amazing time. Leo, did you ever work for Leo as a booker?
No.
No?
No, who are we talking about, Leo Burke?
No, Leo Garibaldi.
No, I've heard of him, but I don't know him.
No, I didn't know if you ever did or not. Yeah, great, fantastic. I mean, creative guy. I mean, he really was. But you worked for Eddie. That was of Graham.
Yep. See, I
that was an education. That was an education, was it not?
Yeah, but I didn't really get the one-on-one with Eddie because I was so green and I hadn't earned that spot yet. But, like, Dusty, you know, sat under the Eddie Graham learning tree. So did Bill Watts. I mean, Eddie was the guy that is responsible for the episodic wrestling that we know now as far as the hot, you know, terror heels that came through and destroyed everybody till they got to the top babyface. And, you know, the cliffhanger and all that was Eddie Graham. And Dusty and Bill Watts learned that from Eddie. And I was very grateful to be a part of, you know, both of those, working for Dusty, even if I did upset him. And then, you know, Bill Watts, he took good care of me.
And
Kevin as well.
Earning tree as well.
Yep. Kevin, I think, was the next generation after that. he took a lot of the Dusty, the Watts, the Eddie Graham, and I think he almost brought it to the next level as far as making it more cultural and cutting edge.
Was it because he was able to come in and roll with the times? Because that's always been something I've been always impressed with Les with, and with your career too, because you have such a long, you know, a long post-wrestling career doing what you were doing, is the fact that both of you guys, you know, for as much as Les, you know, would get the crotch of the old man and he'll make fun of himself for it and things like that sometimes, he's been able to stay and roll and know what's going on now today. And you have as well. It seemed like Kevin Sullivan was able to do that for his time as well, too.
Kevin is one of the smartest guys. Yeah, and I think Les will agree with this. Kevin was smart in a lot of different ways. I mean, he knew how to get people to do what they didn't want to do. He was a big-picture guy that saw, you know, long-term storylines. He also knew the detail part of stuff. I mean, Kevin, and he was a great storyteller. I mean, if you think about it, at 5'2" or whatever he is, he's probably 5'6". I'm trying to be funny.
He heard you say that. He'd be 10 foot tall. He'd be bowing his
back.
He'd
beat me up, I know, which he can do. But my point is, he's short, he's got a funny accent, and there's nothing impressive about him until he starts working. And then he's so good that he convinces people that he really is demonic and he really is tough and that he's really, you know, out of his mind. And he could convey the same thing in the way that he got over as a wrestler. He could make people get over and tell his stories the same way when he was booking. Kevin's brilliant. I'm a huge Mark Kevin Sullivan. I think anybody who knows me knows that. And I credit him.
You know what? When you described Kevin, Terry, you actually were describing the same. Leo Garibaldi is the same way. Leo was a tremendous babyface. I remember as a kid myself watching he and his dad, you know, from the L.A. tapes and stuff. But he was the same way. He would get up in the, you know, he'd come in to give you a finish, and he'd start waving his Italian arms, and he'd get emotionally involved telling you about it, and he'd get you psyched up to do it, by just hearing him talk about it. You were fired up, ready to get out in that ring and go for it, you know. And, yeah, Kevin was that way, too, as well. You're absolutely right.
Kara, how do you make a guy, how do you make a guy who doesn't want to do something? Is it just for a guy trying to appease all of these different guys you got to appease and try to make them do certain things? I mean, what was there one thing? I mean, is it just knowing the psychology of the guy and being able to talk to them, or I mean, are bribes having to be done? I mean, how do you try to make guys do what they just don't want to do? Big tough guys with their own opinions. How do you make them go along with the plan and convince them it's for the best?
Well, a lot of them, if you can explain to them in the big picture how doing what they don't want to do now will benefit them in the future, by either keeping them employed or putting them in a top spot, or saying, hey, if you do this job for this guy now, you know, in 6 months or in 3 months, there may be a spot for you to do something else with another guy. But the last thing you ever want to do is lie to a talent or mislead them, because that ends up biting in the rear end bad. Hey, we got a great angle for you coming up. You know, do this favor and we're going to put the U.S. Western Heritage States title on you. And by whatever reason, whether it's your fault or somebody else's, that you don't do it, you've lost all credibility with that talent. And then the word gets out, and then, you know, you just can't lie to the talent. You can tell them, you know, the story and say, this is what we need you to do for the good of the company, and they can either choose to do it or they can choose not to. But then, you know, it's just, if you're doing what's best for the company, it's usually pretty easy to sell to somebody.
What was the hardest, if you can say, I don't want you to throw anybody under a bus or anything, but what was the hardest one you had to go through? I mean, and I know that there are WCW's issues with contracts and things like that, but was there one you could talk about where it just took forever and a day for you to get this guy to do it, and then it ends up paying off dividends where, you know, they came back to you and went, hey, I'm wrong?
I'm sure there was, and I'm not being evasive. I remember somebody come up to me and saying, you know what, I didn't want to do that, but now that we did it, I think it was the right thing to do. And we get that a lot, and I think Les probably does too, when you have a talent that doesn't see the big picture. But a lot of times talent can only see through their own eyes. They want to protect their brand, and they don't understand that if the Golden Goose, which is the company, if it doesn't stay profitable and do well, I don't care how good their brand is, they'll have nowhere to work. So a specific instance, no. I mean, we had a lot of people where we were pulling teeth, but most of them weren't doing it because they were hateful or it just they didn't know any better. They thought something, or, you know, they got paranoid or somebody got in their ear. And, you know, at the end of the day, most of the guys do what's right. It's just getting them to it.
Yeah, it's Mike, what you got to understand, when you got a roster of wrestlers, boy, there's a lot of testosterone floating around there. And, you've got to weave your way through it. And I mean, I wouldn't say you're a politician necessarily, but you've just got to make them understand how they're a piece of the puzzle and how the whole puzzle fits together and how they're valuable in that puzzle.
Yeah, and Les is right. I mean, you've got to have linemen, you've got to have quarterbacks, you've got to have, and everybody, you know, hey, you may be the second string right tackle right now, but if you do real well, you may get moved to left tackle and start, and that's the highest paid part on the offensive line. It's very important. You know, you have to have everybody do their job to make the overall company better. And I think Les will agree with this. Performance and attitude, good performances and good attitude will bring the cream to the top. It really does. I mean, guys that can work can't be held down. When Steve Austin was brought up to WWE, they didn't want him to talk, and he was the ringmaster. And they knew enough that once, you know, Steve's performances, and he said, hey, just let me try talking. And they said, okay. And they went, holy crap, this guy's good. You know, the talent. And guys staying with it and having the right attitude about how they pitch, you know, their desire to try to do something. You know, I mean, if they pitch it the right way and then they, you know, over-deliver, then they've earned the right to do it over and over again. And guys that earn it should be allowed to do it. The guys that just think they're entitled, that's an entirely different story.
Right. You know, I think the thing that's missing today that we had when Terry and I were in our prime. Of course, he's still younger than his prime now. But
I was going to say, at least did we have a prime?
But you mentioned, you use the term role players, and that's, there are no role players. I mean, there were guys, for example, Johnny Heidemann, who was a tremendous worker, a veteran, who was the guy at mid-card or you know, lower card, who got the new baby face over and yet was good enough to still maintain his own credibility, and that's the way he made his living. He was not going to be put on top. And there aren't role players in that particular sense any longer.
Well, without trying to sound braggadocious or puffed up, I was never a top guy. No, but I was never a top guy. My job was to get guys ready for JYD or Duggan. I was like the second, not the top baby face, but one or two down from him, that whenever they were getting a heel ready for Duggan or JYD, that heel would come in and you know, we'd have a good build up, and that guy would decimate me. He would beat me and, you know, mess me up. And I knew I was doing that to get this guy in a position to draw money with Duggan and JY. The thing I didn't know when I first started doing it, which I was happy to do, I mean, I never cared about winning and losing. I just, somebody said to me, you know, do you mind doing this? I said, it's fake when I win, it's fake when I lose. I don't care. And I just never cared about that. But then I found out after, you know, I put the guy over and JY had his run, or Duggan, on the way, the guy the heel's way out, they would put me over. So, you know, it ended up being okay. The deal is a babyface that stayed in the territory. If the guy came in and beat me and, you know, the people saw him, oh, boy. And then as the guy, you know, the next time we wrestled each other, he had already lost to Duggan. But then, you know, we'd have a little angle and then I would win. It would give me my credibility back for the next guy that came in that I had to put over for JY or Duggan. And it was a good formula, and it worked great for me. And, you know, I didn't have to be a top guy, and I had a great run. Very grateful.
I agree, you know, and you know, there were territories where I worked on top and territories where I did what you're talking about there, too. And I remember in 71 when Louis Tillette called Danny Miller and I into the Tampa office and said, hey, the Crockett's are looking for a number two babyface team in Charlotte, and we've suggested you guys are interested in going. It was never, well, we don't want to be number two or we want to be number, you know, it was like, okay, yeah. Because you knew you were going to be, you know, you were going to make good money, and that was a good spot. You know, well, at the time, George Becker and Weaver were the top babyface team, and you knew since Becker was the booker, it wasn't like you were going to push him out of the top slot anyway. But
I thought you were going to say George and Sandy Scott, but that was a good one too.
Yeah, well, there were so many good teams up there at the time anyway. But that's the thing, Mike. You just. You know, you were offered a spot, or it's like Terry will tell you, you start calling around territories and somebody said, yeah, we need a good baby face or a heel in the middle of the card, or you need a top, you know, you knew going in that, you know, this was your spot. And if you got over and, you know, the first time I worked as the third man with Becker and Weaver back in the 60s, I didn't go in there as that, but it fell into that spot. It worked the first time. So they started, you know, it got me a good run with that. That's the other thing, too, Terry, you know, I've talked about with Mike and Rich on this show, too, is a lot of things that fell into place and worked, they weren't planned, but you saw, you know, but the good bookers saw them coming together and they said, yeah, let's run with this.
Yep.
And
talent rises.
Yeah.
Talent will rise.
Yeah.
And you don't have to say if you don't want less, but what was your biggest guarantee per match? I have a reason for asking.
Oh, wow. You know what? I'm trying to think. I don't.
Well, I'll tell you mine, and I think you can kind of attest to the same deal. Mine was $50.
I was going to say 50 or 75 at the very maximum.
Yeah, well, mine was 50. They said, we'll pay you $50 a match, and if you do well, and, you know, you get over and people start, you know, we start drawing, you'll do better.
Right.
And I never wanted to be told how much I was going to make. I wanted to be told what the minimum was, and then allow me and the guy I'm working with and the other guys on the card to come together and have the best matches possible and compete against each other to outdo each other to make the whole show better. So we'd all make more money.
Right.
And it seems like now with guys on guaranteed deals and, well, I'm going to make $300 whether I win, lose, you know, go 3 minutes and have a great match or go 25 minutes and have a, you know, a really good match. It seems like, you know, it's just different now. I mean, I never had anybody tell me what to say on a promo, and I'll bet you didn't either. And
no.
Nobody ever told me what to do in a match. There was no agent. There was no writer. If you didn't know enough to get yourself over, you found another place to work.
Right.
It's so strange now. You know, a lot of the guys like Austin, I mean, he took it on himself to get over.
Right.
He had confidence in himself, and no matter what the gimmick was, he didn't care. Give me an opportunity to get on TV, and I'll take care of the rest. And
yeah.
He did.
I think now that you're not involved with anybody, if you sit and watch the shows as I do, you're not, I mean, you're not under contract or anything, without knowing some of these kids, you realize they're put in a characterization or a promo situation where they're not comfortable. You and I sense it. The fans don't sense it in that respect, but they do realize that subconsciously that this is not that person. This is not, they don't, as you said earlier about strong, saying if you don't believe the promo, then nobody else is going to believe it either. And that's, I think that's the serious problem with writers as well. A writer, you know what's now, you've worked with, I mean, closer with, I've never worked with the writers in WWE or even sat down with them. I mean, I've met them and so forth, but I've always thought, you know, and say, well, this guy wrote this, wrote for this TV show or did for this movie. Well, they tried to match the story person up with a character that fit the story. And I see so many wrestlers now that don't, you know, it's like you're putting a square, you know, trying to put a square peg in a round hole and it doesn't fit. And I keep thinking, why are they doing it differently with wrestling than they would have done it, you know, with a movie or a TV show? But I think that's in part why some of these kids never get over, because they're, you know, they're given an uncomfortable role and never given a chance to be Terry Taylor or Les Thatcher, you know, in a dramatic sense.
I agree with that, but I have like a little different take. Do you remember when Mick Foley spent his whole life being this hardcore, you know, Cactus Jack character that just absolutely decimated himself physically by what he did to try to get that reputation? Well, then whatever he did to get noticed by WWE, he goes up there and they change his name and make him a different character called Mankind. Now, Mick could have complained, and he could have said, I'm not doing it, and I don't like these words, but he did what he was told to do, laid the groundwork, and earned trust, and at the end of the day, at the end of his run, he ended up being Mick Foley, who he wanted to be to begin with.
Right.
And
yeah,
I think because he did what he was told to do, he earned and got equity with the company as far as his performances and his loyalty and all that, and he was rewarded at the end of the day for being who he really was, which was Mick Foley.
Yeah.
And I think if guys, and Mick stayed with it. I mean, he did, what was it, 3 years he was Mankind, and then they kind of, you know, let him spread his wings a little bit.
Right.
But, you know, I just think guys, I think the art of guys, you know, learning who they are, and, you know, sometimes you got to read the words on the written page to earn the right, you know, produce that and do it well before they're going to let you, you know, kind of jump in the deep end on your own. And I think, I don't know if that they ever say, you know what, I'd like to try to do this my own way.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's, we were talking, you know, talking about the Strongbow, you know, comment about the whole promo thing or cutting an interview. I know I was talking to somebody a while back about Wahoo. And, you know, I said, here was a guy that if he, you know, took that microphone and said, you know, Friday night in this building or that building, I'm going to kick so-and-so's butt. You went to the bank with that. There was nobody listening to that didn't believe, Wahoo believed every minute he was going to tear this guy, you know, apart. And that's what helped bring the people to the building, because you believed what he was telling you. And I think that the emotional involvement is lacking. With all the high spots and you know, they're so into all the other stuff that they forget the fact that when the bell rings, you've got to draw the people into that ring with you. I can't speak for you, but I think probably I can too. And the fact that as a babyface, to go in there and sell and build to the comeback was as much fun as making the comeback, because you were feeling those people coming with you. And once you blew it off and they came with you, it was like that. I mean, it obviously wasn't the financial payoff it was going to buy groceries, but it was the payoff for the hard work.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I found out as a babyface, as I got over, and being over is a whole lot different than trying to get over. I mean, there are different ways to work matches, and you know that. But like,
sure,
you're over and the people are with everything. I didn't have a shine. I didn't need one. When I was over for Bill Watts, we'd go out there and we'd wrestle around a little bit, and I knew we were just biding time until the guy cut me off. So I'd say, cut me off. Let's get the heat and start building it.
Yeah.
And you know, and this is kind of a segue, but we would tell guys now in the modern era, one guy's job is to sell in a tag match. One guy's job is to make a comeback. The other guy's job is to set the table and get as much heat as possible. And your job is to sell, so when you tag your partner, the people at this perfect fever pitch dying for him, your partner, to come in and beat these two heels up that have been beating you up for the last 20 minutes. And I see guys that are on the outside come in and stop the heat when the guys that are in the ring, the two heels, and the babyface that's selling are trying to set the table for the guys on the outside, and the guy on the outside won't let them do it. And it, you know what I mean? It's just, and I know it's hard to stand on that apron when they're killing your partner, and people are going, "Get in there, you chicken, you SOB." They're killing your partner. Well, give me another 6-7 minutes, and you'll really be mad at me. But when I start throwing these guys around, you'll like me again. And
right.
It's hard to stay in that corner and have people cussing you.
Sure.
Boy,
but you know, work. You could work. I know you're probably the same way. If I was a guy on the outside, there were times I'd blow myself up working the corner.
Yeah, but the point is that nobody wants to lay the groundwork to set up the comeback. And
right.
You know, they just want to get to the next spot.
I'll tell you a funny story about that real quick. When Scott Casey came into the Carolinas, he'd been down in, he started in Texas with the Funks, and then they sent him to Tampa, and Tampa sent him up to Charlotte, and George Scott gave him to me as a partner and said, you know, the kid hasn't worked a lot of tag matches, so, we're going to teach him to tag psychology. Okay, fine. But anyway, he and I were working with the Andersons in Greenville, Ole and Gene. And I'm setting him up for the hot tag, and we're just having. I mean, I'd worked in the Andersons so many times anyway, and I'm just having a ball, fighting for the corner and them drag, doing their heel thing and drag me back and doing the Anderson thing as only the Andersons could have done it. They were tagged team heels personified, and in the midst of me selling with for Ole. I all of a sudden hear Ole say, "What the F are you doing in here?" And I kind of look up, and here's Casey really breaking up, killing our heat.
And I know exactly what you're talking about.
He's green as grass. And the horrible answer, I mean, obviously, so we kind of had to, back up and start rebuilding the heat. And when we got downstairs, of course, Ole and Gene lit into him. And bless his heart, he was so green at the time. And they said, "Why the hell did you come in there?" He said, "Well, the fans told me to." I thought, okay, you're a fan.
We talked about listening to the fans.
But, yeah, to me, that was fun, too, selling in the tag matches and fighting for the corner and everything. I mean, I don't think, Terry, that we could sit here and talk forever and not make those who have never worked in those situations with that kind of talent to really understand how entertaining we were to ourselves trying to manipulate the people.
I've laughed out loud in the middle of a match before and knew that if I got caught, I'd get fired.
Yeah.
But working with Dennis Condrey and Dutch Mantel and guys like that, they do stuff in the middle of, when you least expect it, and I would horse laugh. But I'd bite my lip or I'd, look down and cover my face with my hair or say hit me or something. The last thing I wanted was to get canned. But it was so fun. I mean,
yeah.
When you were relaxed and trusted the guy and you knew that he wasn't going to hurt you and that he knew what he was doing and he was always going to be where he was supposed to be, and the matches were fun and easy. My first 10-minute Broadway was with Norvell Austin, and I'd been in the business about 6 months. And I said, "Oh, my gosh, how are we ever going to go 10 minutes and not have a finish?" That match was over before I even knew we had started because Norvell was so good.
Yeah.
We didn't do a lot. He laughed and he told stories and he was relaxed. And the next thing I know, I'm making a comeback and the bell rings.
Yeah.
Man, this is
I was on a show last week and they were talking about the Royal Rumble coming up and said, "Do you have any remembrances about Battle Royals?" And I said, "Battle Royals were just a lot of fun. The boys aggravating one another." But then for some reason it came to my mind. We were up in Lakeland, Florida one Saturday night. And Mike, if you don't know, Lakeland's what, Terry, 30 miles from Tampa or something like that?
Tampa, yeah, real short. And a good town, too.
Yeah, good little town. And so anyway, the arena we worked in, I don't remember the name of the building, but the actual arena was on the second floor.
Lakeland Civic Center.
Okay, there you go. But we were able to get together, Heel and Babyface, in the dressing room. And for some reason, we were having a battle royal. And there was no big – we knew who was going to win it, but there was no big deal in particular in the order. As Terry said, there were no agents or anything. So we were just trying to figure out who's going out first and this and that. And the other thing, did you ever work with Eduardo Perez, Terry?
No.
No, okay. Here was a guy who would make you bring blood, bite through your tongue, bring blood, make you – he was so funny and make you laugh. But anyway, so – there, you know, everybody's talking and trying to lay out, you know, the order of exit from the Battle Royal. And Eduardo opens up his mouth. And he said, you know, guys, I forget what it was. Some show was on television that night. And he said, why don't you throw me out first and I'll go home and watch that show. And, of course, that was the wrong thing to say. And so the game that night in Lakeland in the Battle Royal was to see how long we could keep Perez
out.
Yeah, that's he right. tried to throw himself out. He tried to jump out. And I think he was finally down to the last three anyway. he missed his TV show anyway. But, yeah, it was. We had so much fun, Mike. It was just – we got paid for having fun. But, you know, the great thing about it is we got the people emotionally invested. We you know, and entertained ourselves in the interim as well. So it was, you know, I go back and look at it, Terry, and obviously we all made our mistakes, and there were things that we probably should have changed because we weren't mature enough at the time. We look back and see that now. But and overall, I wouldn't trade it all for anything. Would you?
No, sir. I'm grateful for the mistakes because it got me where I am. And I made every mistake there is, as painful as they can possibly be. And those are the ones where I learned the best lesson.
When he talked about locking up with me and disfiguring me for life, Mike, at that point, you know, when he said he and Steve were in college together, well, that was Terry came. I'm a college graduate. I wasn't. But I think he will also tell you that his years in the ring gave him an education that he couldn't have gotten in Harvard or Yale or any place else. Would I be right, Mr. Taylor?
Yes, sir. You know what's funny about the wrestling business is, you know, everybody's got a little angle, and the old-timers used to work each other. You know, there was no office that would promote people, and there was no, you know, there was a promoter and a guy who was, you know, running the town, usually because he owned it. And, you know, guys would try to get over on each other to try to get to the main event. And if you had to step on somebody to do it, you know, in a sneaky way, guys would do that. And, you know, you had to learn back then how to protect yourself. And a lot of those lessons I learned in the ring were things that, you know, guys used trying to, you know, the old-timers knew a lot of ways to make somebody look bad without ever beating them up.
Right.
And, you know, you talk about lessons and stuff. I'm grateful for every one of them. I was going somewhere with this, but I think I've got brain damage. So I'll act like that was my thought.
Well, Terry, I'm really honored that you gave us, you know, it's almost been an hour now that you have been on, and we do have to wrap it up. What are you up to right now? Are you just sitting back enjoying the world, or what are you doing right now?
Situation. I've had a very unique last 6 months, and without going into a whole lot of my life, I've had family things I have to take care of. So I haven't worked in 6 months, and I take care of my son. So right now, that's my number one priority. So I'm not in the wrestling business right now, other than this last hour I've spent with you guys.
I tell you what, I really, as a longtime fan of yours, I really appreciate you coming on here. And, you know, Les, you got anything else for Mr. Taylor?
Well, I'm really a longtime fan of his, too. Terry,
oh, by the way, I hate both of you because not only has my mother's favorite wrestler, well, was Magnum TA, even though she hated wrestling. Her second favorite wrestler was always when Terry Taylor came on the screen. And she had a chance to see Les Thatcher's, some of his bodybuilding pictures. And my wife had a chance to see Terry today in a couple of minutes because I was showing her who we were going to be interviewing. And got the same thing my mother said 20 years ago. So I hate both of you guys. Anybody else who's genetically gifted like you two.
Well, we hate ourselves too, so we're all in agreement.
Before he goes, I just want to say that I've appreciated his friendship and respect over the years. And my friend, I love you, and God bless you, and I wish you the best. And please stay in touch with me, okay?
Well, I love you too, and you're a great guy, and I'm very grateful that you guys let me on here. Yeah, wonderful. It was wonderful for me.
Oh, thank you, Gary. We'll be right back on Georgia Wrestling History.
Yo, what's up? This is the Black Eyed Peas, and we're here for RAD, recording artists, actors, and athletes against drunk driving. Music is one of the most important things in our lives, but nothing is more important than life itself. And when you drink and drive, you're risking the life of yourself and the lives of everybody on the road. Don't plan to drive, just plan ahead.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
This heavyweight bout is about to begin.
What's the champ wearing? Looks like an examination gown. And from the back...
Ooh, that's not pretty.
Champ, what's with the get-up?
I've got to take care of my family, so I'm getting those important medical screens.
The fight is over! Champ, you look pretty healthy out there tonight.
But I'm still getting those tests. For a list of tests you need, go to AHRQ.gov. And remember, real men wear gowns.
Go to AHRQ.gov. This message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AHRQ, and the Ad Council.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Red Gunkel or Gordon Solie? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
Everyone loves to listen to music, but have you ever stopped to think about why it's great for kids to learn to play music? Hi, I'm Darius Rucker from Hootie and the Blowfish. These days, it seems people focus way too much on the economics of school music instead of an amazing positive effect it has on kids. It's such a thrill for a child when he or she gets the first instrument or masters a simple part on the flute or performs a showstopper with a school chorus. And there's so much music out there to play and listen to. When kids learn to appreciate a show tune, a Beethoven symphony, or an opera, in addition to what they hear on the radio, it only opens their young minds to the diversity of the world around them. Make sure your kids learn to love music. Support your school music program.
A PSA brought to you by MENC, the National Association for Music Education, and the National Anthem Project, the campaign to restore America's voice through music education. March is Music in Our Schools Month.
This is Miss Rachel from The Empire, formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling. Every Friday night, The Empire presents the best in professional wrestling at the Academy Theater in Avondale State. We're also at the Masquerade every month or so. Check us out on Facebook. Just look for Platinum Championship Wrestling, and you'll get the latest details on all the hottest action from The Empire, formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling. We get it. That's every Friday night at the Academy Theater and at the Masquerade as well every month. We'll see you there.
Some statistics are surprising, some are unbelievable, and some are simply unacceptable. Right now, nearly 30% of U.S. students aren't finishing high school. Nearly 30%, and that's the average. In many places, it's even higher than that. And fixing it is a responsibility that we all share. This is President Obama, and I urge everyone, not just parents, but friends and neighbors and family members, to take responsibility for encouraging the high school students in your communities, to support them, challenge them, push them a little, and do whatever it takes to help them make it through. Because this is one statistic we simply can't afford to ignore.
You can do your part by going to boostup.org and sending an email, a text message, or even a wake-up call to a student at risk of dropping out. Go to boostup.org and provide the boost that's needed to make it to graduation. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
Hey,
women have heard of Jalop. If you heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Gets it straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style, moving all along.
All right, we're back here on Ringside Rap. Mike Sempervivi along with Les Thatcher, and great, awesome interview with Terry Taylor. And yeah, I was not lying when I said that about every time Terry Taylor was on TV, and my wife would, you know, my mother would make a little sound, and my wife just didn't. True also about you, Les, and I actually had printed out here from the interview and the Mike Klein, did some Mid-Atlantic Wrestling memories, and I'm going to pull up his website here so I can actually give it to everybody. But the picture of you talking, as you talk about you coming to the Carolinas for the first time, there's a picture of you, a profile shot of you, hand on chin, thinking, you know, looking deep out into space. And my wife looked at it today and it's like, who's that? That's Les. Oh.
That's half of a picture. Gene Gordon shot a picture of Rudy Kay and I, and Rudy is in the same pose, just on the, looking at the picture, I'm trying to think in my mind, who is on the left, am I looking toward the left or right as I face you?
You're looking towards the right.
Okay, well then he would have been on the opposite side looking to his left then. But yeah, we were both sitting in that position. That's when we were. That would have been. That was shot in. It had to be 60, probably 67. So I was about. I was 26, 27 years old at the time. And gosh, that's been a day or two ago. You know. Yeah, I enjoyed. I was thinking while we were in commercial there, Tate's taking a big sigh of relief. Well, Thatcher couldn't get too negative tonight, and.
and
he didn't have to hit the squelch button or but hey, I you know, if we don't have that kind of guest next week, I'll be back to my same old self.
Oh, by the way, Mike Klein's site, mid-atlantic grappling greats .blogspot.com, which, you know, it's a, I believe it was a three parter altogether, just chronicling you getting burned with the fireball. And how you were able to get your event at the end, and it's a must read for anyone listening to this show. It's an absolute must read for. But before we wrap up the show, there's something I've been wanting to ask you for weeks and weeks now, but I haven't gotten the chance to. I finally saw Memphis Heat, and
I'm sorry, I missed what you said. You saw what?
Oh, Memphis Heat.
Oh, okay.
I only saw the documentary, and I was something I had not known. It was a story that Jerry Jarrett was relaying about you traveling with Nick Gulas, and you know, he would bend his ear on things, and he said, "Oh, I thought it was just car talk," but then he started to give Nick ideas, and Nick was, you know, taking credit for him. But then he came out and he said, "You know what, Jerry? I want you to, you know, that everybody should know that you're the one, you know, coming up with this stuff." And Jerry said, "Yeah, I don't know. I'm young, a kid. I don't know if they're going to buy this stuff or not." He said, no, I want you to do it." And he says that when he started, and he was, I guess, given the book outright, or was told, you know, everybody was told that Jerry was running the show, he said, "The top baby faces in the territory, Ken Lucas, Les Thatcher, Dennis Hall, all quit."
Yeah, I've embraced with this, and that's not actually true.
I didn't think so.
I didn't know that I was credited with that until the Memphis Heat thing was put together. And no, I think that's the reason Luke left. I'll see Dennis in Mobile, and I'll have to ask him. No, honestly, I had come back when I was working on Top in Knoxville. This is when John Kazan had. I know we don't have a lot of time, and I'll try to give you the digest version of this. Nick was always, for some reason, Nick was making money off of Knoxville too, but he tried to screw with that whole situation. And there were times that John would say, well, we can't do this angle because you won't be on TV tomorrow. And I'd say, what do you mean? Because Knoxville was Friday night and the TV was Saturday morning. He said, well, Nick says you're booked such and such. I said, no, I'm not. And honestly, I made money in Memphis, which is where Jerry, Memphis and Knoxville were, you know, for me anyway. I mean, it was a big territory, but those were the major towns. I didn't work Birmingham that much or the Alabama end of the territory. So I had left and gone up to, speaking of Rudy K, I'd gone up to the Maritimes for Rudy in the summer of spring and summer into late October of 1970, and came back into Nashville. And so went, you know, right back to work with John up in Knoxville, and Memphis was fine too. But then Nick started screwing around with me again. And one of my mentors, one of the people that really established my philosophy and psychology a lot about what happens in the ring, as I mentioned earlier, we were talking about Leo Garibaldi, and Leo was that person. And Leo was booking Tampa at the time, and I just got tired of screwing around with the thing with Nick. And other than Memphis and Knoxville, you know, the business for me wasn't that good in the territory, and I had the opportunity to go to Tampa and work, you know, with a great crew down there and work for Leo. And I've been in Tampa before. That's where I was presented the NWA Rookie of the Year Award in 67. And so anyway, I had a chance to go back down there. So I took the opportunity, and it really, you know, tell you the truth, I never had any cross words with Jerry. Jerry and I always got along. In fact, I remember when he started as a referee and then, you know, became a wrestler and the whole nine yards. But, yeah, that was not, you know, and until I heard about Memphis Heat, I never realized that he had the impression that that's the reason I'd left either. And when I saw him up at Scott Teal's, not this past September, but the year before, when Scott had the Tennessee Legends thing, we were able to talk about it. I said, no, you know, is I'd like to take, I'm glad you give me some rollover credits in the show, but that wasn't, you know, that honestly was not the reason that, you know, it wasn't Jerry. I mean, it was the way Nick was, you know, was trying to manipulate the whole thing with Knoxville again is the reason I thought this enough's enough, you know, and so I went to Tampa.
Well, that's the thing. He didn't come off like a jerk about it or anything like that. It was just like, you know, I came in and those guys ended up going. I wasn't sure if there was any editing or anything like that in there. And I tell you what, one thing I did, you know, because I've heard stories, I know you've talked about them, Richard, guys have talked about. I am now, I don't know how old he is, I'm afraid of Billy Wicks. I'm pretty sure Billy Wicks can kill me right now. I'm putting him up with Danny Hodge.
Billy's a sweetheart of a guy. He lives near my in-laws in Maggie Valley, Waynesboro, North Carolina area. And so I get a chance to see Billy every once in a while when I'm down there. And Billy's having some health problems now. And last time we actually got together, he was using a walker. So you might have a chance to get away from him. If he got his hands on you, he may be able to stretch you a little bit. But, yeah, Billy's a sweetheart of a guy. But, yes, he was a – well, I tell you, I can't think of the kid's name, damn it, right now. But one of the young men that Billy taught to catch wrestle actually goes to Europe and England now and gives seminars on catch wrestling there and has competed at a high level in catch. So, yeah, Billy's legitimate. There's no two ways about it.
That's awesome, man. I know Rich will kill me if I don't get the plugs in this week because I didn't get them in last week. I'm still getting back used to being in the main host chair here. I'm trying. These intros and outros I have to show is completely awful. But for all the news, and again, you know, talking to Danny only earlier on, again, go to GWHnews.com. You know, obviously keeps you in touch with a lot of what's going on in the wrestling world, especially on the Georgia scene. But you got to read his, again, the thing that got me at the end of it, and the thing that really struck me, when he said, you know, yes, professional wrestling is not a, you know, used to be a closed business, but now that, you know, it's open, it doesn't mean we can let all these other donkeys in. I'm paraphrasing there, but that was, you know, that was one of the things I thought that was really,
yeah,
you know.
Like I said, you know, I was glad he called in because I, you know, I had no idea he was going to, and I just read that today, and then, you know, he and I had, he had actually, Rich had sent me a link, and then, but when I got home this afternoon, Danny had sent me the actual copy. But, yeah, there, you know, the content at the end, you know, is where, yes, if you're, you know, if you're not going to be, if you're not going to give the business the respect and dedication that it deserves, then don't do it. Step aside. Because, you know, the problem is the guys like Danny who actually want to work their way up in the industry maybe are not directly harnessed by those who just want to play at it, but they're held back because they have to work with those people. And without those people having the same – well, you heard the way Terry and I were talking about, you know, caring about, you know, if you don't believe it. And one of the things that Terry is fond of saying and we didn't mention tonight is, you know, with our generation, when you came through the curtain or out through the dressing room door, you went out there selling a shoot, although you were working, you know. And that's not the attitude or the mentality any longer for most of these guys, and that's a shame, you know. It's and I'll tell you, for those of us teaching, Mike, it's the frustration is, you can be with a big group of guys, and I've tried to steel myself mentally from that and realize that, you know, if I teach the hobbyists as well and make them do better, then that's a good thing too. But it's tough to, you know, when guys like Danny that you've worked with who really sincerely want to become better say, well, you know, I try to apply what you've taught me, but these guys I'm working with don't want to do that because it's simpler to sit and lay out a couple of, you know, things instead of trying to be actually creative. Because like Terry and I were saying, the way our generation worked is far more difficult than trying to lay things out in the dressing room. But the crazy thing is, if you wanted me to lay out a 5-minute match step by step, I doubt seriously that I could do that because mentally I've never been, you know, put into that position and never wanted to be in that. And the great thing about what we did was you are able, you know, there's no really boundaries to that creativity. You went out there and worked to get the people's reaction, if you know, as a babyface or as a heel, and to enhance that and like he was talking about, to build to the heat and the comeback, and that's not there anymore. And that's a shame because, believe me, even the kids that think it's better to lay it out step by step, if they were able to feel what we have been able to feel, I think they would, you know, they would appreciate it and embrace it even more than what they're doing now.
Another guy that I don't even have to say anything. Tomorrow night on Peach State Pandemonium with Mike Norris, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons. Bob Armstrong. Bob Armstrong is going to be on. And much like Bob and Terry Taylor tonight and Les, you every week, I just, you know, one of the best things that you guys do, for as much as people, you know, with mindless, faceless internet, you know, names and things like that, the best thing you guys can continue to do, too, is to continue to talk about it and teach and keep it alive and keep it going. And, you know, this tonight was another, you know, just again, and tomorrow night's going to be that way too with Bob Armstrong. Just very thankful that you guys continue to do this when you don't have to, and very thankful that you continue to do it.
Well, thank you, Mike. Yeah, and Bob is a tremendous guy. I love him to death, and I feel I've always been made to feel part of the Armstrong family. And that, you know, that's something, again, I don't mean to get into a long dissertation here, but something that Terry sort of touched on, we never really put into words, is the camaraderie. And, I mean, not that there weren't guys that were odds during our generation, you know, or just had disagreements, but there was a camaraderie to the business that it was, you know, because, and in part, I think, because it was a closed business, you know, that we were compelled, to take care of one another, and it was a fraternity in the strictest sense. But it was one of those things. Even if I disliked you immensely, and it broke down into a riot or a bar fight or something, I have your back, or somebody else had yours. That was always the case, I just don't think, it's not, I don't mean that these people are, this generation are not sensitive or are heartless necessarily. It's just they're not in a position to make them, to be forced into that type of camaraderie that we were.
Now, unfortunately, I have no camaraderie with Rich Tate whatsoever, because he just told me there's only 15 seconds. So, everybody, Les, thank you very much. And everybody else,
thank you, Mike.
Thank you very much, and we're going to see you. Talk to you next week. Terrible
All right.
outros.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.